Lab, everybody. And before we get the show underway, I just wanted to let you know we're trying a little bit something new in recording the show. Dave and I both have FaceTime launched on our iPads so we can watch each other as we're doing the show. And kind of we've been coming up with a system of signals and hand gestures. I've been trying a few hand gestures out on Dave already before taping began. And so just to let you know, we don't know how this is going to work out. So if there's a couple of weird glitches or anything, we wanted to let you know right off the bat that we're experimenting.
Right off the bat. I'll tell you what, technical glitches aside, it's already throwing my game that I can see Brad. All his little gesticulations and grandmotherly movements are throwing my game. Because normally I'm just... So for the folks at home listening, I'm normally talking into a box that's filled with foam and crate. So I'm imagining what Brad's doing in this moment, right? But now I can turn my face and literally see whatever... little, knickknack that Brad is knitting or whatever it is that he's doing. God knows what grandmother will think. So I have to tell you guys how Brad says goodbye on FaceTime, right? First of all, when you FaceTime Brad, I don't know if you've ever FaceTimed with a 65 or 70-year-old and they're holding their phone and all you see is the top of their forehead or the bottom of their chin because for whatever godly reason, they don't know how to hold a phone. So... when you FaceTime Brad, you either get all nostril or like, hey, it's the forehead show. Welcome to Brad Geiger's forehead show, right? And that's delightful because you tell Brad and then he tilts the camera down. But then when he says goodbye, and this is the most amazing thing that I wish I could share with people about Brad. So I want you to imagine a baby octopus in a water pond, right? And then the baby octopus notices the camera and squirts away real quick. And so the legs, all eight legs go out, in, out, in, out, in. And you see them going away, right? That's how Brad waves goodbye on FaceTime. He does... The hand is totally still, but the fingers go out in, out in, out in, out in. And it's the, it. I don't know, how did you learn to wave like that? Who waves like that?
I didn't realize that. How are you supposed to wave? That's how you wave.
There's two ways to wave. You could either wave at the wrist with a slight undulation at the elbow.
What am I, the homecoming queen?
Or you could do the... you could do the Queen of England and hold the elbow still and do a curving motion with the wrist. Or you could do what Brad Geiger does and put a baby octopus at the end of your hand that's suddenly been startled and the fingers go out in, out in, out in, out in,
well,
out in.
That explains why I get so many strange looks when I'm telling the driver ahead of me that they can go next in traffic, you know. I do that so that so there's lots of visual cues. It kind of gets your attention. There's a lot of contrast.
What it looks like from my end, it looks like I have taken an iPhone and traveled back to 1890s vaudeville, and there's an actor going, Sean, I can wave goodbye for you. 23 Skidoo, here we go. In, out, in, out, in, out. Bye-bye. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye. Oh, I'll just drink my sarsaparilla here. Sure. Anyway, I have to say, now that I'm growing used to it, I'm enjoying seeing your face as we podcast.
Yes.
This is nice.
No, this is very, very nice. I think this is a much better...
And then he just hung up on me. Oh, my God. Grandpa had a moment. Oh, my God. Anyway, we got Brad back on the visual, and we're ready to start. I'm just going to quietly turn to the camera and do a signal that says, Grandpa, don't touch your iPad again.
And I'm going to turn to the camera, and I've got a signal of my own.
Oh, oh my God, I like this already. All right. But on that note, I am going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, doing the octopus wave to all of you. I'm also the cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and the co-director of Strip.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. And fun news, a new sponsor for 2020, Brad Geiger. Oh, a new sponsor for Comic Lab.
I'm so excited about this. We are thrilled to welcome to the Comic Lab family, Sideshow Collectibles.
Sideshow Collectibles, a huge juggernaut in Southern California, Brad, as you know, making incredible collectibles, statues, toys, delightful. I mean, I have Sideshow on my drawing desk. I actually have a 1/6 size Darth Vader that you have seen.
Yeah.
It is gorgeous.
That came from Sideshow. I remember admiring it in your studio while I was there. It really is impressive.
Oh, it's delightful. And so in addition to all the stuff that they're making in the world of collectibles, they are also creating content like Sideshow Podcast with the comedian Jeff May, which is specifically sponsoring Comic Lab today.
Yeah. And you know what I like about Jeff? He's a comedian, you know, so he knows how to be funny. He knows how to make things interesting in a podcast. He's just a joy to listen to. And that on the podcast landscape can be a little bit tough to find. But Jeff's bringing after show. Yeah.
And the show, you know, it's focusing on pop culture. So it's got all sorts of like comic creators that you and I, both writers and artists that you and I love. So Jody Houser from Doctor Who, Scott Lobdo from X-Men, Top Cow's Henry Barajas, our friend Brandon Bird, who also a Los Angeles resident. And then artists like Scott Koblish of Deadpool, Phil Jimenez of Wonder Woman. The list goes on and on. And they're all delightful because Jeff knows how to get the funny out of them.
You know? And they've got not only comic creators, Dave. I've listened to this show. I've listened to comedians, voice actors, even a model / entomologist. Believe it or not, which was a really good
saw,
show.
The old model entomologist saw. Boy, you got the standard podcast guest. And so it's all pop culture related. So fans of this show will enjoy it because it's creators talking about the things they're fans of, what they love, what inspires them, what they loved as children, what they're reading now, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so if you want to check it out, and my gosh, why don't you? It is at side.show/comiclab. They made it super easy. Once again, side.show/comiclab, which raises the question, Brad, why did we not know that .show is a suffix for podcast?
I had no idea until just now that you could even do that. And it works perfectly for Sideshow because that's their name. So they go side.show, then they throw up a slash comic lab, and they're going to show everybody right there at that URL what we're talking about. It's super smart.
I wonder if there's a dot. I mean, because really, that is perfect for their show, for their name, that it's side.show. I wonder if we could do dot lab as though the thing.
Could we do
comic.lab?
That's got to be available out there somewhere.
Look at, here's Grandpa and Grandpa, all the guys. We're just figuring out the FaceTime, and we're learning about how the internet works. Anyway, there's also, just to round it out as a thank you for hosting the show, I should also mention there are full video playbacks of the episodes with Jeff available on Sideshow's YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And once again, that's Sideshow Podcast with Jeff May. Sponsoring the show, and we give a huge shout out to them, and thanks for sponsoring. Definitely go check out the show on side.show/comiclab.
All right. And now, Dave, now let's talk comics. And I've got a question from one of our $5 Patreon backers that I want to talk to you about, because honest to goodness, it's really interesting. Over the past couple of weeks, I've heard this topic being talked about on social media an awful lot. It's like this is maybe with the beginning of the year that it's on everybody's mind, you know, kind of starting the year off. So here's a question that I pulled from our pile that I think we're going to have a lot of things interesting come up off of. Here it is. Comes in from our friend Kevin, who says, lately I've been trying to put more work on the fundamentals for my artwork. I recently had the idea that I should try to find a mentor that I could point out the fundamentals I needed the most work on. I feel too close to my work to know when something is good. And I would imagine that works for knowing where the areas are that need to be strengthened as well. So his question is, how valuable do you feel mentors are? And when might someone consider trying to find one? And I would guess the unspoken question there is, where could you find a mentor?
Well, now, wait, now, legitimate question to you, Brad. Are you honestly seeing this a lot on the internet and on social media?
No, that isn't just a transition. I really have been seeing.
That isn't just a transition. I'm not just fumfering here. I really had this happen.
No, I've seen mentor come up on Twitter an awful lot.
Well, so my first thought about this is that I'm of two minds of it. One, I remember being in my 20s when I got hired in kind of an intern-y way onto the San Diego Union Tribune. It was the local big paper in San Diego. And I think I've told this story before. I got to do 2 days of editorial cartooning, and another cartoonist who will remain nameless for the purposes of this story got to do the other 5 days. And I came in, Brad, like, oh boy, I'm going to learn so much from this older cartoonist. He's going to teach me all the ropes. He'll take me under his wing.
We're going to be buddies.
We're going to be buddies, and we're going to go out and have milkshakes together. And, but that's a common theme in my life.
Yeah, a lot of milkshakes.
And this professional could not have given less of a shit about the little 20-year-old who was doing 2 days a week.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, so-and-so, how do you get that Pantone color to work the way you want it? Nope. Okay, I'm out of your office again. Bye. I'll just remove this boot from my ass. And he couldn't have cared less. And now that I am probably the same age that he was then, yeah. I kind of see, like, he's like, this is not my job. I didn't get hired to train this cartoonist. They hired this other little cartoonist. He can learn the way I learned, which is throw him in the deep end, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And maybe there's truth to that. But I got to say, in my 20s, I wanted it so bad, right? I wanted to have a mentor that would handhold me. And frankly, that's a key word, I think. I wanted handholding, right?
Yeah.
And the truth of it is, now that I'm older, I think if you want it, it's a version of that thing in that saying you get what you pay for in life.
Yeah.
And if you want instruction, you need to pay for an instructor. And if you want a teacher, you need to pay for a teacher.
You're saying that we should have to pay for mentors?
No, I'm saying you can't expect another cartoonist further along. Like you and I, we like talking comics, so we make this podcast.
Right.
But we've talked before, I do not like the act of teaching comics. I don't like it. And so when people ask or approach me for, and I can feel it coming for like a, hey, could you kind of guide me through how to do this? And I'm like, don't ask me, don't ask me. Because I was not put on this earth to be a one-on-one teacher or a classroom teacher, I don't think. I mean, I might at some point in my life try it, but I can do lectures and guest lectures and I'm happy to do that, but I guess what I'm saying, Brad, is it's a big expectation to go to a professional cartoonist and say like, hey, can you mentor me? I want you to be my mentor. In addition to all the other things you have in your life and career going on, can you mentor me? Now, having said that and realizing that I sound like Scrooge McDuck, there are cartoon studios like Helioscope that offers their internship / mentorship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they do a beautiful job. And a lot of those cartoonists have gone on to the first stages of fledgling success, right? Which is lovely. Anyway, I've talked too long. Brad, what do you think about mentorship? How does someone approach? I've been Grumpy McGee right out of the bat here.
Well, listen, I will say this. I was kind of surprised when you were talking about the monetary involvement of mentorship. Although, to be honest, that's kind of what I do on webcomics.com, which is by necessity subscription-based. And that's what we do on our Patreon, which you need to subscribe to be involved in the main parts of what we do through Comic Lab. In other words, the Discord server, being able to ask questions and get us to answer it and stuff like that. There is a monetary involvement in there, I guess. But but at the same time, I guess I come at it a little bit different when it comes to one-on-one mentorships. And that's because I've been involved in kind of doing that for a long time with interns from the University of the Arts and stuff like that. And I'm on the other side of that. In other words, I like doing it. I like talking comics to somebody and kind of being able to give them some information that they didn't have and stuff like that. The problems that I see, however, are numerous. Number one, I think I get very, very, I get very uncomfortable when it comes to giving and listening to advice. And so my first thing I'm going to say is right off the bat, be very careful who you allow to mentor you. In other words, coming as a younger cartoonist, you might kind of think that this is a seller's market for mentorships, right? Anybody's willing to give you the time of day, you're going to take it, right? You're thirsty right. for mentorship, right? But look at that person's work, look at that person's career, their track record, and so forth, and ask yourself, do they have what it takes to really give you good information? I see this time and time again when somebody says, oh, I've got somebody who looks over my comic before I read it. They're like a quasi-editor. They look over it and then they catch things and they help brush it up. And it's like, does this person really know writing? Does this person really have the chops to be giving you this kind of guidance? Who are you accepting guidance from?
Right.
So that's the first thing. It's like, be careful who you're accepting guidance from.
Choose wisely at the outset, basically. Don't just go with Johnny Joe Schmo that like,
yeah, I guess you could use the sharp end of a pencil. That'd be fine. You know,
what was that voice?
I like that was a very Muppet voice and I'm here for it.
No, it was kind of Muppety.
No, but I would, number one, be careful who you're taking advice from. Now, on the other side of that whole argument, if you're going to have a mentor in your life, be prepared to listen to what that person has to say. And I'll tell you exactly what I mean. And I'm going to, and by the way, I adore this person. I think the world of her. And I know she listens to the show and she knows I'm going to out her. She knows exactly where I'm going. I had an intern from the University of the Arts. And she's very good cartoonist. She's fantastic. But she's got this thing where she draws all of her characters with really long necks. And I looked at it and I go, what's with the long necks there? And she's like, oh, that's my style. That's how I draw. And I'm like, you can have one character with a long neck, but if you've got all of your characters with these spindly long necks, it's going to be distracting and it's going to be an impediment to the reading process for your readers. No, she says, that's how I want to draw. And I, of course, part of being a good mentor is also knowing when to back off. I cannot force my aesthetic on somebody. However, right. I will tell you, I'm very confident. It's a look that I think she's going to grow out of. But what I did is I took that hardcover collection of Greystone Inn that I had printed, and I flipped to old Greystone Inns, and I said, take a look at how I was drawing eyes back then. I'll tell you exactly, with 20 years of hindsight, I was drawing the eyes really weird. But if you would have asked me when I was her age, why are you drawing those eyes? I would have said, oh, that's my style. Because I wanted to be different. I wanted to stand out, right? I wanted to be unique.
Right. This was going to be this was the Brad Geiger look. Yeah, you were going to have that.
This was going to be me. The equivalent of Gary Trudeau. You know how he drew those screwy eyes?
Right, right, right.
I was going to draw screwy eyes. He didn't have the market on screwy eyes. I can do screwy eyes just like him. The problem is his was a veritable style that grew out of how he was drawing. Mine was just like, well, I'm gonna do it this way. And boom, I was drawing these. And you look at the old Greystone Inns. I put them up on Instagram every day. You can see it was a terrible aesthetic decision, but I felt the need to be different. And what I didn't know is that a good style, again, like we've said on the show 100 times, your drawing style is not something you see through the windshield. It's something that you discover through the rear view mirror. After you've been driving for a while, it develops over time naturally.
Right.
And this is something I had to learn. Now, she's going to learn that lesson too. I guarantee 10 years when we see her work, those necks are going to come right into shape. They're not going to be these distractingly long, spindly necks. And, you know, she's still going to be unique. She's still going to find an aesthetic that is her own. She's not going to need to force it. But I can't force that on her. And I can't, I know with 20 years experience that she's going to get there. I can't right. force her to get there. And at the same time, I would argue that she'd be really probably speeding things up a little bit if she'd listen to what I'm saying and take it to heart. But in that regard, there was lots of good things about a mentorship. That's one that I wasn't able to get across. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I feel like the mentor-mentee relationship on the behalf of the mentor, and I can only speak in context of having done Webcomics Weekly or Comic Lab, this show, or How to Make Webcomics, mm-hmm. which is that a big part of the altruism of doing it is wanting to save someone time. Like, learn from my mistakes. Yeah. My God, if I can save you 3 years of making this mistake, then I made the world a little bit of a better place, you know? And so that's a big part of why a mentor or an instructor or a teacher or even a podcaster tries to share what they know. So it's like, God, please learn from my mistake and don't do this, right?
Yes.
But the weird thing about a teacher-student, a mentor-mentee relationship, a podcaster-listener relationship is there are a lot of mistakes that you can't be waved off of. You have to make them and stumble through them. And it sounds like, because I had this same period, Brad, where people were, I also had weird eyes, and I thought it was my unique bit of comics that was making me a special little snowflake, that I drew eyes like nobody else. Well, the reason why nobody else drew their eyes that way is they look stupid. And it took me 7-8 years of comic making before I realized that. And no matter how much as a mentor you might wave her off of that neck approach, and then also there's also the humility as a mentor or a teacher, where you go like, hey, you're drawing your eyes too big. And meanwhile, Margaret Keane is like, I think it's going to work. And you're like, no, you're painting these eyes too big. And Margaret Keane is like, just trust me. People are going to like these paintings. And you're like, no, I don't like them. The eyes are too big. And Margaret Keane's like, give me 5 years in the art market. I guarantee I can sell this painting for $100,000.
Well, that's why mentorships is a two-way street. And that's why you've got to be very careful who you're getting into the relationship with.
You got to find someone that works for you. Yeah.
Because as a mentor, you can only give advice. You can't make things happen. As a mentee, there's some advice that isn't going to be a good fit for you, or you don't think is going to be a good fit. It's a weird little dance that you're doing. And that's why I come back to my first point, and that is that I think you have to really be sure about who you're getting involved with.
Right. And I want to skip themes here for a second, because I have to mention again to everybody that we are on video this time for the first time ever, where I can see Brad and see what he's doing, right? And so I want to tell you all, because this is important, you need to know this, I am feeling attacked. Like, my tone is maintaining smooth, but in the meantime, I'm sweating in my podcast because Brad's gesticulations, when he makes a point, the finger is coming towards the camera of the FaceTime, and he's pointing at me like a drill sergeant telling me to drop and give him 100, and I don't know how to react to this. We've never had this on the show where I can see him gesticulating, and he's so forceful in what he's saying. Then even when he's making a point, there's fists, there's fingers, there's hands being punched into hands. And I might have to turn the FaceTime away from me, because I'm feeling like Brad's going to punch me through FaceTime. He's making a point about mentors, and he's physically pointing at me, and I don't know how to react to this.
Nobody needs to see what goes on while I'm doing a podcast. I'm very expressive back here.
Brad has literally been transported off the mean streets of Philly into the podcast, and he's pointing at me and he's telling me how to feel about mentors, and I don't know how to feel about this.
Oh God. Well, listen, I've got one more point, and then we're going to go over to the next question, and that is one last thing I do want to say, and that is, if you're going to be a mentor, because let's face it, your heart's in the right place. Maybe you've been doing this for a long time and you've got the track record and the chops, and you want to pass some of that on to a younger person. The only thing I'm going to say is this: being a mentor is a big commitment. In other words, it's not just, you know, checking in with somebody and tussling their hair and saying, oh, geez, good job, Jimmy. Keep up the good work. You've got to be ready to get in there, get into long conversations.
Commitment. Yeah.
and an ongoing commitment for an awful long time. If you're going to be a mentor, you got to be prepared to start a relationship with this person and continuing it on, because otherwise you're doing that person more harm than good.
Right. And I will. So let me give some actionable advice at the end here to wrap this up. So if you are looking for an internship, a mentorship with established cartoonists, more often than not, I have noticed in my career that studios will offer mentorships rather than individual cartoonists. Because then the weight of it, to Brad's point, is not on one person. It's like, hey, let's have the eight of us mentor this young 20-something, right? Because we all believe in them, but we don't individually have the time to give them what they need. So let's the eight of them. And so, for example, Helioscope in Portland does it. I believe Carl Kerschel's studio in Montreal does it. And we can ask Carl when he's on the show in a couple of weeks. There's a few other ones around this. Like, I think Cartoon Studies in Vermont might offer something like that. What I'm saying is do a little bit of internet research. Know if you approach a cartoonist at a Comic-Con, they are not in the right mental space. They're selling, they're promoting, they're marketing. They're not in the right mental space to give you mentorship in that moment, to give you advice in that moment. That's always a tricky time for a cartoonist to step away from their what they're doing, which is selling and trying to make their living, to mentor you. So be careful of that. And to Brad's point, find someone who is like you. There might be a kinship in the, oh, I see a little bit of myself in this younger cartoonist.
Right.
And that kind of affinity might generate the desire to mentor you. So find someone who is like you, but also don't be hurt if they say, I just don't have the time. I don't have the energy. I don't have the wherewithal to do it.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be a tricky find, I will be honest, but if you're set on it, I think you might be able to do it. And then I will offer one more point, and hopefully Brad won't gesticulate onto me on the camera here. Boy, that sounds terrible.
Yeah, that sounds horrible.
I realized how that sounded. Oh, God.
Sounds like we were doing a completely different show.
That's a very different podcast.
Which we could probably charge more for.
Oh, God. You ever say something and then you hear what it sounds like and, oh, God, I'm flushing the cheeks. What I was going to say is one of the greatest things that a liberal arts education ever did for me is that it taught me how to learn, how to teach myself. And so I will say this. One of the best ways you can continue your education as a cartoonist, as an artist, is to read broadly and widely interviews with cartoonists, because every interview has one snippet that you can take away from in your own career, you know, every panel conversation that you go to. So it's when you want to be a cartoonist, it's not just head down, pencil in hand drawing. You have to be head on a swivel, reading a lot of interviews, reading a lot of trade stuff, going to a lot of panel talks, because you will continue to learn. I continue to learn by reading interviews with people when they're on NPR or when they're on Comics Beat or when they're on Comics Reporter or Fleen. And so keep learning basically on your own is one of the greatest bits of advice I could give you.
And I'll tell you exactly how you can do that. And that is by listening to a show like this. It happens all the time. Every topic we talk about in this show is about you. And I'm talking to the individual you, not the group you, but every topic we talk about is about you, the person that's sitting right there. You've got to figure out how that connection is made. But there's been so many times that we do a show where I say something like, you know, this is how you do a Kickstarter. And a person comes in and sends us a question through Patreon and says, how do I do a Kickstarter for blah, blah, blah? And I write back, we've addressed this on this show at this time mark. And the person will say, oh, I didn't know that applied to me. Well, listen, all of this stuff applies to you. You got to figure out how it applies. But everything we say really does apply to you. You can take, there's something for every topic that specifically we're talking about your situation. If you start there, there's a bunch of mentorship, 2 years and counting worth, that you can access right now just through this show and a bunch of other shows that are out there. Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute and stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, Brad and I are going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
Yeah, because, you know, when you do, you'll get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And an exclusive Patreon post that go even deeper on the Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, no worries.
You can still support the show by rating us wherever you get podcasts.
Leave us a 5-star review and a few kind words.
And that, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
And now, let's talk comics.
All right, Brad, our next question comes in from our friend Manuel over at patreon.com/comiclab, and it says, "Hey there, Brad and Dave. Over the past 8 months, I've been working on my graphic novel for my senior thesis." Ah, cool. Congratulations, Manuel. "And now I feel like I've grown tired of working on it." Uh-oh, wait, it's going south quickly, Brad. Especially after getting a small amount printed, 100 trade paperback books. What are some common practices that you do to bring that inspiration back and start creating with a fresh mind? Also, thanks for the entertaining and informative show." Thank you, Manuel. And yeah. I do mean congratulations on that sincerely for the senior thesis. That's a cool accomplishment. Oh. So definitely. But let's jump into this question, Brad. So I would like to put a little focus on a part that I think is really key here for Manuel, is that he finished the senior thesis. It's a chunk of the story, and he printed up the first 100 pages of it. And I want to put emphasis on the printed up, the physical copy of it, because I think that's important psychologically, don't you think?
Yeah.
To what's happening here?
Because what's happening is his brain is saying, "I'm done.
We've reached the finish line." Yes, you had the same reaction I did. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So how do you get around that? Well, there's a few things that come to mind. Number one is to break out of the mindset that says you only have to work on one thing, like in the old newspaper syndicate days, where this is my Garfield, and I'm going to work on Garfield for the next 20 years.
Right.
The best way to break out of it is to do something completely different, to start working on a different project. Doesn't mean you can't come back to this at some point, but to give yourself the freedom to work on a different project, to say, "Hey, I'm going to do something else for a little while. Maybe I'll come back to this."
Exactly. And I think the very fact that you are feeling hesitation after 100 pages, let's look at the parameters of how this project came about. You were probably assigned doing X number of pages for your senior thesis, right? Or something physical had to be turned in. So there was an externality that made you do this project.
Yeah.
And the fact that when you have already put 100 pages in, now it's up to just Manuel doing it at his desk, and he's like, "I don't know." Maybe that's telling you that this is not really the project that's firing you up. And that's okay too. So a part of it is the guilt of like the sunk cost fallacy. Like, well, I put 100 pages in, so now I got to do the next 400 pages. Whereas maybe to Brad's point, it's smart to step away, do 10 pages of a little short story, do 5 pages, just do 1 page single jokes for a while, just maybe illustrate for a while, maybe just write in a cafe for a while. That's okay too. You have completed something very big in the life of any student. And now it is a question of what do you, Manuel, want to work on versus what your teachers want you to work on. And that's another conflict that I think that's happening, is the what's firing you up. And it sounds like if 100 pages of a story is done and it's waiting for you to go to page 101 and it's not firing you up, then I think that maybe that's something that needs to be looked at.
Well, you know, something that they did at the Beacon Journal when I used to work there in the mid-90s, I had a really good kind of a mentor and boss named Susan Mango Curtis. And see, my thing at the Beacon was I did these—
Wait, can I pause you for a second? The middle section there was Mango?
Mango, and she just went by Mango. You just called her Mango.
Of course you go by Mango. If part of your name is Mango, I'd be like going up to strangers on the street saying, "Call me Mango."
And I could not imagine calling her Susan. She was a Mango. I mean, that's just she had.
That's a delightful name.
Yeah. She talk about somebody with a big personality. She had a huge personality, and she really did mentor me in amazing ways, and really helped me take my newspaper career to the next level. in part yeah. by kind of facilitating. I was the one that did these big, big, full page, double truck graphics. Like I've got one that's still hanging in the studio where I went in and showed the inner workings of the Goodyear blimp, for example. And I did a lot of these things where I would show an exploded view of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I would be doing these big projects that took months to complete at the same time I was working deadline graphics. And she always built in a kind of like a refractory time, right? When the Goodyear blimp printed, for the next 2 or 3 weeks, I was just kept on small projects, not even breaking news, just putting out the weather map every night and doing the simple, because she said, after you do something right. like that, you need to give your brain time to rebound from that. And she made sure that I just worked on small projects for the next couple of weeks until I was ready to even think about the next big project. And then when that time did come, I was mentally prepared for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a metaphor here in farming, which is like if you ask a half acre to produce, a billion ears of corn there or whatever a half acre produces. Yeah. Dave Kellett, big on farming. But, you can't harvest that corn and then immediately go, all right, we're doing soy. Come on, soil. We're doing soy right away. Produce a bunch of soy. I mean, you got to give it a second. And I think the natural cycle of creativity is, like Brad said, there are ebbs and flows where if you do something big, if you finish a big accomplishment, you do have to give yourself a little bit of a break. I am kind of a workaholic, but I've gotten better in my years of seeing that my creativity needs those moments of, and sometimes it's literally just an hour in the morning to just drink coffee and just read for a minute, you know? But anyway, that I don't know why that's particularly helpful, Manuel, but I'm just saying, it sounds to me like there's a couple things going on. One is that this was an externally assigned project, and maybe not something that you would have generated 100 pages of on your own. The next one is that now that it's done, there's a psychological sense of accomplishment, and like the physical object is there, and you're like, well, that's why do any more? I have the physical object. I can show it around. That's also a fair psychological point. And to Brad's point, I think like after a big thing, it's good to take a step away creative moment and do a couple of smaller bite-sized chunks. So I hope that in some way helps Manuel. And I think, Brad, you want to jump in the next one there?
I had one more point I wanted to make on that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So let's say that all that advice that we just got done giving is good in general, but it doesn't fit you because of whatever reason. You've got to keep working on that central product that you're doing, that central feature, and you don't have the ability to necessarily try doing something else or to have a fallow period or something. Take into account this, and it's something I talked about just a couple episodes ago. My son comes up to me a few days ago, and he's really getting into writing. He's writing this this whole Call of Cthulhu / detective mystery thing that he's really, okay. really hyped about. And all of a sudden, one day he comes to me and he says, "Dad, I'm over it. I've hit the wall, and I'm just not interested in this anymore." And I said, "Do me this favor. You put this much thought and effort into it. Do me one thing." He says, "I can't write. I've got to the end. I can't write anymore, and I'm not done. But I can't." I said, whoa. "Here's what you do. Meanwhile," he says, "What do you mean?" I go, "Meanwhile," I said, "you're at the end of a scene, right?" He goes, "Yeah." I go, "Now in your mind, say meanwhile and change the scene and start telling the story from a different point of view. Continue the narrative, but from somebody else's eyes. The story's still moving forward, but you've gotten out of that room that you hit the wall in. Now you're going at from another point of view, from another standpoint, from another angle, from another room, from another city, from another planet. Do a meanwhile. Just try it." I said, just right at the top of your page, meanwhile, and then take it off from someplace else and see where you go. Comes home the next day. He says, "I've been writing all day in every free period I've got at school, study hall, this and that." He says, "You were right." He says, "This is a great story again." And I'm like, "Yeah." And all it takes is meanwhile, and you can kind of fire up again.
You know what's an interesting, I'm going to add on to that, an interesting little add-on for the idea of switching to a meanwhile is that writing technique where if you know that you're someone that takes a while to gear up for that first writing session or the next day of writing or the next day of drawing, an old trick that a lot of novelists use is they will finish the big scene and write, and they're ready to go, and they're putting their keyboard or their pen down for the night. And the one thing the writer will do is she'll write the first line of the next section.
Yes.
Or the first bit of dialogue before she goes to bed, because she knows that the starting for her is the hardest part of all. So she'll wake up the next day and she'll go, oh, this bit of dialogue's already started. Like it's greasing the wheels for future you. And so that doesn't necessarily help you, Manuel, but it's good for all of us to realize that in our creative moments, when all the engines are firing and the coffee is churning through the system and you're ready to go, maybe that's worthwhile to write the next line. Or even if it's, you know, you might not use it entirely that during the next session, it gets you going. It's a prompt for the next, for future you. So anyway. Manuel, again, congratulations on the senior thesis. And by the way, both Brad and I have had that moment, so you are not alone.
Yeah.
But I think with some of the thoughts that we've had here today, that'll be helpful to you. But on to our next question. So, Brad, this one comes into us from our friend Eric Campling over at patreon.com/comiclab. And he says, hi, question answerers. thing will never shake. My question is about time. More specifically, what are your thoughts on synchronizing or not synchronizing the passage of time with real time? So, for example, a comic year is a real year versus a comic year taking 9 months or 2 years in real time to tell. Thanks so much. Brad, what is your thought on that? Synchronizing time. I know for a good long while, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. Lynn Johnston had that kind of aging in real time where the kids were, if it was, you know, year one, they were 11 years old. If it was year two, they were 12 years old, that kind of thing. What are your thoughts about a story moving along or aging in real time?
I would much, much rather focus on writing a good story. And aging in real time seems to me, number one, seems to be kind of a limit to that. In other words, now you're focusing on, oh, is it October yet? I've got to get all this story done. And there's a lot of times when everything that happens in October might take a couple months to tell well. And if you're sitting there counting the days, you're not writing good stories. You're paying attention to a gimmick, and gimmicks are, well, fine, I guess, but I'd much rather write a good story. So I am not that fired up about this idea. In fact, I could see it taking the focus away from your writing in that you're trying to cross your I's and dot the T's and stuff. And instead, you're marking time. I'd say make a better point in your mind to write a good story.
Well, I'm glad you put that the emphasis on that, because when I read the question, my first thought was, well, how lovely, how cute, what a fun idea, synchronizing the time. But you are right. You are right, though. And I'm saying this sincerely. You are right to put the emphasis on, no, listen, don't get so caught up in a shtick that you're like, I got to stick to my shtick. I can't write the way this story needs to be serviced. I've got the shtick is more important,
right,
you know,
right?
Because let's say you catch a bit of flu. Let's say you break your wrist. Let's say a thousand other things that could cause a hiccup and the story goes wrong. What do you do then?
Like, right.
It's do you jump back in 3 months later, even though the story doesn't call for that? No, you don't do that. So it is a perfectly fine, I think both Brad and I would say, it is a perfectly fine and lovely way to tell a story. But remember that the moment of creativity and the moment of first reading and its first existence in the world is not also the full life of that piece of art. Right, Brad?
Yeah.
So even though this shtick works, I keep calling it a shtick, but even though this creative approach works for this moment of release, your ideal world, that art is going to exist in the world for the rest of your life and onward, right?
Yeah.
And so no one will have remembered that it got created in real time. They'll just remember the strength of the story. So I think Brad's right. Keep the emphasis on the writing and on the story. And I think that'll serve you better in the long term.
Absolutely. So, Dave, I've got a question for you over here from the $5 Patreon pile. And it's got a follow-up. Actually, I paired these two together because they had a similar theme. So we'll take the first one, and then we'll kind of go off into a follow-up. You ready for this?
Alrighty.
Our yep. Patreon backer, Alistair Cooper, writes, how might cartoonists reduce their carbon footprint? Dave, how might you reduce your carbon footprint as a cartoonist?
Sorry for laughing. I guess to reduce the amount of carbon in my life, I'd have to cut down on my number two pencils. That's it. Ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba.
Hey, good night, everybody.
I'm here all week. Da-da-da-da-da-da. No, how would I reduce? Okay, let's answer this seriously, because we all owe a debt to future generations, mm-hmm. and this is a massive problem of which, if we're going to be honest about it, corporations are causing 99% of the problems and individuals are causing 1%, but we can influence corporations and our own actions. So yes, of course, we should consider it. The good news here is that cartoonists, for the most part, of all the industries, creative endeavors, jobs in the world, do not have that high of a carbon footprint.
Right.
I mean, it is not like I need a barrel of oil a day to create a comic. Mm-hmm. I've got, if this coal doesn't get burned, Brad, no comics get made. I think the big one that both Brad and I would agree on for, and frankly, I think this is more to Brad's strength than to mine, mm-hmm. is that if you want to cut down on your carbon footprint, stop flying to conventions.
Right.
Don't you think, Brad?
Yeah. And that's also high on my list of how do I improve my business in the next year? for about 8.5 out of 10 of us, it's stop going to these conventions that aren't making you money. And I've talked about that ad nauseum. So I won't go down that road too much. But if you're also looking at carbon footprint, and that's something that's very important to you, then you stopping doing comic conventions and fly, particularly if you've got to fly, then that's got to be tops on your list.
Right. And so let's look at the other major ways that cartoonists make a living.
Yeah.
Book production is a huge part of all of our, not all of our lives, but the majority of cartoonists. Mm-hmm. You could, if you were feeling guilty about it, pay for... not carbon offsets, but basically tree foliation offsets, where you fund or at least assist in the funding of reforestation when you make a book. That's one possible way. But in general, again, I go back to the idea that cartoonists, aside from the minimal power usage that is used for your local computer, your local internet service, your basic functioning of your life, flights are going to be a big one. And books are going to be the big one. And I think that's about it. But Brad, what else? What do you think?
Well, this
what
is
else
actually, could be done here? You started to go down the road of our follow-up. So I'm gonna bring our follow-up in because you started down that road. This comes in from Angela Boyle around the same time. And she says, more so for publishing, do you take the environmental impact of shipping from overseas? Like if you do business with a printer over in China, or in South Korea, do you take that environmental impact into account? Do you pick a paper that is harvested sustainably, makes use of recycling? How much of that do we recommend? And being honest, how much of that do you and I do in our daily lives?
I will be 1,000% honest is that I don't yeah. in that regard. Unfortunately, like a billion other consumers, I don't consider the sustainability of the foresting that I make my books from. Mm-hmm. And is that my fault? Yes. I take ownership of that. I perhaps should. I think it is all of our faults that we all collectively sometimes put, you know, fingers in the ear and hands over the eyes and be like, la, 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 I'm doing what I can, but I can't save the world by myself. And so, yeah, I take ownership of the fact that I don't seek out sustainable foresting. I honestly, though, Brad, I don't know how I would. I don't know in the chain of book production, there might be smaller ones in the U.S. or Canada that actively say, look, we reforest once we harvest, mm-hmm. or we raise forests that are better for this environment or that environment. But I can't think of one offhand. You know, all the ones that have survived are the big ones that were a little Machiavellian, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's something that you could definitely take into account with a conversation with your printer. I mean, you can get in touch with your printer and say, hey, I'd really like to make this book emphasize environmentally friendly processes. And by virtue of doing that, you can add that to your marketing. You know, if you're going to go through that level of concern, you owe it to yourself to put a little note in there and make that part of your marketing. Say, hey, this takes into account certain things, and I want you to know about it, you know?
You know what? Actually, Brad, I'm going to jump back in because I'm remembering now that a conversation that I had with a printer over email about 4 or 5 books ago was there was actually a choice of paper that had a percentage of recycling in it versus pure white, pure new, pure foresting pulp. Mm-hmm. And I did opt for that, and I've been using it since. So I forgot about that. So yes, you can absolutely have a conversation about, like, do I need to have the purest white-driven snow paper, or is it okay, actually, and it actually complements my art to have a slight recycled content in it that actually sometimes, depending on the paper product, looks great and looks better for your art style. So yes, that you can do, and I would recommend that. But I was just speaking honestly that it's hard to find these bigger companies that offer, like, hey, we're a completely sustainable printing company, and it is ultimately a not great business, I think, for sustainability, I think. I mean, I'm honestly racking my brain trying to think of conversations I've had in the past where, like, no, we're great for forests, or we're great for the inks we use. And I'm hard-pressed for finding someone who was not also, and I'm saying this sincerely, who was also not 6 times the cost of using another printer. You know, Brad, like, you could always find a small mom and pop that'll help you source a paper, but you won't be able to make a profit on it. So then the question becomes, well, then how the heck do you make a book for at a profitable point, you know? Yeah. And that's both heartbreaking and the sad reality of the world we live in. So, it is a tricky one. But I take comfort in the fact that as a cartoonist, I'm not requiring a nuclear power plant be built on my behalf. I'm not shoveling coal. I'm not, I personally, as an individual, can put solar on my roof. I can make my next car purchase electric. I can encourage my power systems to go towards sustainability, which is a lot of Los Angeles-based power systems are going towards with wind and solar. Brad is shrugging over FaceTime. He's not believing in this, I guess. What else, Brad? What else am I missing?
You can vote. All right. And this is something I don't want to come off like I am poo-pooing this conversation about what can I as an individual do about the environment. Okay. Because it's great that you're thinking about both of these listeners. It's great you're thinking about it, and we should all be thinking about it. But the bigger question to ask is, what can ExxonMobil do to reduce their carbon footprint? What can BP do?
Oh, God, what can BP do? Yeah, exactly.
Their carbon footprint. And the thing about it is, and they do this to us all the time, while we're all concerned over whether we're using a straw or not, they're doing things that is having a massive impact on the environment. And without any kind of recompense, any kind of control, anybody is looking at them and saying, hey, wait a minute, how about what you're doing? We're all so good about doing this, about doing our part, that we forget that there's businesses that are having a massive impact on that. And there, so if you want to really have an effect, also consider about whether the person that you're voting for that takes these matters as important as you do. Of course, if you don't think it's a big deal, that's fair too. You can vote that direction. But if it's something that you think is important, by God, make sure you're registered to vote. Especially, we're going into a new voting cycle here. Make sure you're registered, and then go out there, find out which candidates agree with that, and vote for those candidates.
Well, and I will say one last thing. Brad and I are not the be-all, end-all, or know-it-alls on the possibilities that are out there for living a more sustainable and conscious life. So if you have thoughts about what a cartoonist can do that we didn't consider, by all means, chime in over on the Discord server for Patreon. Chime in under the comments under each Patreon post over at patreon.com/comiclab. Brad and I would love to hear your thoughts.
Absolutely.
And, So, Brad, why don't we jump into the next one?
Okay, we've got time for one more question. This one comes in from Cole Chadwick, and he says, "Hey, Brad and Dave, I'm planning on doing a solo anthology series of short comics where I will be having a different character throughout, like Twilight Zone or the old EC horror comics. My question is, how would you go about introducing a character's personality in a comic if you only have, let's say, 12 pages to do it in? You get like 12 pages for the whole story. You got to establish that person's character within the first page, I would imagine. Is it just through character design, or are there other tips and tricks? Thanks in advance. Dave, give Cole some advice."
Yeah, so Cole, there are, four key things you can do to establish a new character. And Brad, maybe you can think of more than four, but I'm going to do four big ones. Number one, character design. The character design itself can be really informative towards what kind of person they are. Second, how you clothe them. It doesn't matter if it's a character in a sci-fi novel, character in a night novel, character in a modern day story. How you clothe them is a big indicator. The third one would be what environment you put them in. What are they carrying? What are they looking at? What concerns them in the room they're in? What objects do they surround their personal life with? How you choose to cocoon yourself is a big indicator of who you are in this world, right? Mm-hmm. The fourth one is in that first page or in the first pages, the words you use are super key. How do they react to a moment? How do they choose to describe a moment? How do they choose to verbalize their feelings? All those are super key. So I think those four are really critical in a short story in establishing who a character is, what they are, and how they go through the world.
Absolutely. I've got a few, and you know what? Sometimes you get good advice from the strangest places. This trounced across my Twitter feed. And I looked at it, and it's great advice. And the advice comes from somebody that writes a blog about Dark Shadows, the Dark Shadows TV series. Do you remember that?
Oh, right.
Dark Shadows. It's Dark Shadows every day. And I guess it's a daily blog about Dark Shadows. But
God, there is something for everyone, isn't there, right? Brad? Remember when I said before that if you do a comic about Victorian fashions, you will find your tribe?
Yeah.
Someone has found a tribe about Dark Shadows every day. What? Yeah. I mean, how does that exist?
And not only that, but in doing this mental exercise, this person realized that there are three ways of establishing a character and making them a focal point for the readers or the watchers very, very quickly. Okay? And okay. It's this. Okay. There's three ways to make the audience like a new character. Make a friend, make a joke, make a plot happen. Go for all three.
Make a friend, make a joke, make right? a plot. Okay.
So you can make a friend. That character comes up and makes a friend. That's something that immediately zeroes the reader in on that character. Make a joke is a great way to make the audience, you know, connect with that character. And of course, make a major plot point happen. Make something significant happen in that moment. Right? You've got a bomb that's ticking down, getting ready to, go off in the city. And all of a sudden, as it's approaching zero, a hand comes in from off screen and cuts the red wire. The camera whirls around and it's a new character, the character you just introduced. Well, they made a very important plot point happen. Right now, you're going to want to know all about that character. You're going to be cued into them. So I kind of like that. I'm going to steal it for myself. Make a friend, make a joke, make a plot point happen.
I think, Brad, that's also good advice for you today. I think you should go make a friend, make a joke, and make a plot point happen, Brad. Get out there. Get out there and chase those dreams, Brad Gagger.
I can make a joke. I'm not sure about making a friend, and I haven't been able to make plots happen for a long time.
All right. So I will say I'm gonna put this in a slightly different term that I think might be helpful for you as you're trying to imagine how to introduce a new character, which mm-hmm. is one of the things that I love about cartooning is that we get to play every role that would occur on a film set or a TV set, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you'll see where I'm going with this. You get to be the director, the costumer, the actor, the makeup artist, the set dresser, the script doctor. You get to be everything that would be required to put together a TV show or a film. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm saying that is one of the things that I forgot when I said either the look, how they dress themselves, the environment they're in, or the dialogue, the four things that I said earlier, I forgot a fifth one, which is the choices that the actor themselves would make. And so the physicality of how a character carries themselves, which is different than how they're designed.
Mm-hmm.
If someone walks with barrel chest forward and arms back and they're barreling through their day, that tells you a different character than the kind of Chris Ware type character that's the shoulders are slumped and the head is down and life is sad and nothing good is happening.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for spoiling that Chris Ware book. It doesn't matter what title, I just spoiled it.
you cracked yourself up with that.
I don't know. I always find that kind of funny. So the physicality that as an actor you would make, that is also super key towards communicating, because that's how we communicate to other humans as we walk through the life.
Yeah.
Is how do you carry yourself physically? How you dress, how you comb your hair, but also what do you do with your arms? How do your legs shuffle, or do they walk assertively? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the way you make your character move through the scene, the physicality of that is also super key. I think that probably puts a wrap on that one.
Yeah, that's
so. Let me jump,
advice.
Brad. As we close the show, I wanted to share one more of the iTunes write ups, because it's kind of fun to see what people are saying about it.
Yeah.
So this one's coming in from, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing it right, Sirothello, or maybe it's Sirot Hello. That could also be. Dave Kellett in reading. I don't know how to put that together. Anyway, here's the write up. It says, I used to listen to Webcomics Weekly, which is a show that Brad and I and Scott Kurtz and Chris Straub did for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years,
yeah,
for a long,
yeah,
time there. Comic Lab. They said, I used to listen to Webcomics Weekly back in high school when no one in my tiny town had even heard of a webcomic. Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
I used to listen to old episodes repeatedly, starting with my very first paid commission up into my first miserable, lonely contract art job. Now, finding Comic Lab as a happily working artist with a booming freelance career that I owe to the lessons I learned 10 years ago, it means the world to me to work on my art with these guys in the background. Thank you so, so much for getting me through some tough years to where I am as a professional today.
Wow.
That I genuinely have goosebumps reading that, Brad.
Yeah.
Isn't that sweet?
That's like we've kind of grown along with this person. You know, we've been there during a bunch of different stages of their life, and that's kind of cool. That's also kind of a privilege that you've allowed us into your head for that long.
Yeah. I mean, one of the beautiful things, Brad, you probably have a few people like this. With Sheldon, I get it because I had late teens that started reading Sheldon when it first appeared online, 98, 99, 2000, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And now, 22 years later, they're reading it to their first kid who's 4, 5, 6 years old.
Yeah.
And there's something kind of wonderful about that. So I just want to say to this kind reviewer of Comic Lab, thank you. Brad and I wish you the best of luck as your career blossoms and goes forward. And it means the world to us that this show and past advice has been helpful to you.
Absolutely. And that just means that it's only left for me to say that you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been my delightful friend, Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And my friend, Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped, and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media. And today's sponsor we want to give another shout-out to, again, Sideshow and the Sideshow podcast with comedian Jeff May. And do go have a look and listen. It is a delightful podcast, very much in the vein of pop culture humor that you find here on Comic Lab, and that's over at side.show/Comic Lab.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/Comic Lab, so we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/Comic Lab. Yeah, try to keep a tempo over there, Buddy Rich.
I'm not going
to
even look at you. I'm going to... God bless America! All right. All right, here we go. Counting down from five. Why can I see you in the side? I have to turn your camera away. Also, you're doing like a grandmother clap. All right. Counting down from five, four, three, two. Oh, Matt, that's the worst clap ever.
Matt, right. You're just going to...
So, Matt, in the side, we have FaceTime, and I just see Brad like a grandmother